capabilities for Unix. And this is work that we've been doing in Cambridge. Robert Watson, he's been doing this for about 3 years now. I joined him about a year and a half ago to help out. And together with Ben Laurie and Chris Kenaway at Google UK, we've been having a lot of fun and doing what we think is some interesting things, and we hope that you guys will also think it's somewhat interesting. So what I'm going to talk about today is this big problem that we're currently having in application software, the problem of privilege. We'll talk about what people are trying to do to address this today, some of the shortcomings of the approaches that currently exist. Then we're going to talk about our system, Capsicum, where we think we can do slightly better things using different primitives. And we'll demonstrate how this works in practice, how we've been able to use Capsicum in some real applications to do some real things and improve security. So the problem is privilege. And so here's an example of Chromium, one of the web browser, one of the programs that we adapted to use Capsicum. And you do a bunch of different things in Chromium. You know, up here you're just looking at some plain old HTML. Up here you're doing some email stuff with funky JavaScripty, who knows what going on, and you're interpreting languages, and all kinds of bizarre things are happening. Over here we're looking at a video about hacking chip and PIN cards, which is kind of fun, some other work being done in Cambridge. But you've got video codecs going on in there, and that's really scary too, because who knows what's happening there and whether or not that's been done in such a way that there are vulnerabilities or not. And over here, I'm trying to log into my online banking page. And I would really, really like it if all of these things could be kept separate. So we have applications are kind of this point where all of these different security domains come together, and we really want very strong isolation among them. We have scripting languages, we have virtual machines. In some ways, an application like this looks a lot like an operating system. You know, it's doing scheduling, it's hosting other applications that are running code. And what we would quite like to do is keep all of these little bits from being able to access the ambient user privilege to do all the things that a user is allowed to do. So, right, and of course, there are problems in software. Software has vulnerabilities, and we can try really hard. There are lots of good things we can do, but we rarely write perfect software. So what we would quite like to be able to do is to mitigate the impact of some of the vulnerabilities that will be found. So in some ways, this resembles something that has happened before. In the 80s, the microkernel project, we say we're going to take these big monolithic kernels in which anything can touch anything and do anything, and we're going to split them up, for robustness reasons, into little components. And then if you have a failure in one bit, it doesn't necessarily have to destroy the whole system. So this is about robustness. There are some security arguments that you can do more interesting things here. But this was definitely not about performance. People didn't say, let's switch to microkernels to make everything run faster. And in fact, some of the systems that have a lot of microkernel-inspired design elements have still reverted to some monolithic things in order to get things to run quickly on the kind of hardware that we use with the Unix process model and things. And today, we see applications that are starting to do this. So the Chromium web browser that we just showed, it has more lines of code than the FreeBSD kernel. And it's trying to decompose itself, too. But the interesting thing is we're here, in some ways, the microkernel project in its purest form was kind of abandoned for performance reason. Today, people are saying, you know what, I'm willing to take that performance hit, and I'm willing to take my application and split it up into various bits, even though I know it will slow down, because it's just worth it to get these security and robustness properties. And so, this was kind of kicked off by the SSHD separation work, where you have some kind of risky crypto code over here, and maybe if that goes wrong, then things could explode. And then there's a bit over here that can actually store sensitive long-term keys and stuff like that. We keep those things separate. And so the interesting thing is that, in a way, microkernels are kind of back. But in another way, they're really, really not back. A lot of things have changed since the world of the 80s, and when we look at some of these security things this time around, we really are in a very different world. Back in the day, we used to think about a machine that had many users, and you had to keep all these users separate and isolate them from each other. Whereas today, you find you are a user, then I've got a phone here, and I've got a computer there, and I suppose I have a computer here that's relaying my voice to you. And all the primitives that were developed to express security policies before aren't necessarily a great mapping onto the things we want to do today. It's not about keeping users separate from each other. It's not about necessarily enforcing system policies about classification levels and things. It's about isolating application bits. So we're talking about application security an awful lot today, and these applications are really complicated. Some of them have a lot more code than OS kernels. They do reflect competing interests. So you have that thing earlier where I would quite like to keep Gmail separate from HSBC, my bank. Thank you very much. But they both have an interest in how the software is running. I clearly have an interest in how the software is running. The software developers, the OS vendors, all these people have different interests, and they're all kind of competing. And in the case of something like users and Facebook, you might even find that your interests are diametrically opposed. And a lot of these things are about mapping distributed security domains, things like websites, into local applications that run with some kind of isolation. And the notions that we already have of type enforcement labels and users on a system, we find are not great ways of expressing these different kinds of distributed security domains and the different policies that we're really interested in. So what we're really interested in is composable sandboxes, where you can say, I would like to have a sandbox, please keep it isolated and don't let stuff get out. And from that, you can build other interesting things. We're really interested in having delegation that's driven by the structure of applications. So applications already have a lot of structure, and we can take a lot of security cues from this, but currently we don't necessarily do a great job. So the kind of thing that we would like to be able to do is, you know, if you had capsicumized Apache, you already have Apache understands that it's got some, it's got some configuration stuff over here, and it's got some stuff over here where websites live. And we would quite like to be able to say, all right, Apache, I will give you that directory, I'll give you that directory, and you can do whatever you want inside of that, but not outside of that. And then you'd quite like for Apache, as part of reading its configuration files and saying, I've got a website over here that I need to deal with, for it to say, okay, this worker, you're going to go deal with this website. Why don't you just go do that? And I don't have to change things like create new users, which is the username that I'm going to pretend is associated with a certain virtual host or whatever. You'd just like to say, go do your virtual host thing. Here are the files that you need, and you just don't get other stuff. We also don't want to be in the world where in order to add a new website to your Apache configuration, you also then have to go and modify an SE Linux policy, that kind of thing, and that requires all this administrative privilege. We would quite like it if you didn't have to be in that kind of world, but if we could get security isolation just from the structure of the application as it currently exists. So the way that people try to do sandboxing things today, main ways are discretionary access control, I almost call it distressing access control, or DAC, mandatory access control, or MAC, and capabilities. And we'll just kind of run through each of them and how people do them. So discretionary access control is really about users. You have owners of objects, and they can set permissions on objects, and whether that's things like user group world, or whether it's access control lists. It's really about owners saying, these are the permissions that other people have to have in order to access my stuff. And so people try to do sandboxing with techniques like chroot and setuid. And so you say, I start running as root, and then I'm going to confine myself to this little bit of the file system, and I'm going to change my UID so I can no longer do all the things that root used to do. And that's a way of trying to do some privilege separation. Chromium on Windows tries to do something like that with Windows ACLs, where you set yourself kind of a null security identifier, and then anything with an ACL you're not allowed to look at. But the problem with these approaches is that they tend to be really, really porous. So you can often prevent applications, sandboxed bits of code, from accessing parts of the file system that you don't want them to access. But often you can't prevent them from accessing things like the network. And this is a huge problem. I mean, if you say that it's fine, the code is sandboxed, it can no longer access the file system, well, what if it can do arbitrary things on my VPN? I mean, that still is a bit of a problem. Sometimes DAC mechanisms don't tend to protect inter-process communication very well. So you can have a sandboxed a bit of sandboxed code in a Chromium renderer process, for instance, and if the System 5 IPC shared memory stuff for X11 isn't set up, and apparently it used to not be set up correctly in terms of permissions, then that that compromised renderer can completely hijack your X11 session. So that's not really a very tight sandbox. Often these mechanisms require privilege. You can't chroot without being root. So you have to have set UID binaries, or you might say you can only do this if you're a system binary that normally runs as root and then drops privilege. But it's kind of perverse when we say, in order to have least privilege, you have to first acquire more privilege so that you can lose some privilege. That just seems kind of wrong. And where this comes from is the fact that DAC is really about users. And if you can express a security policy in terms of users on a system, then DAC might be a good fit. And DAC is very useful for certain things like that. You know, you want to keep your files separate from some other student's files or whatever. That can be a very useful mechanism. But for application sandboxing, this really is a poor fit because it's very difficult to express the policy that we want in terms of users. So mandatory access control, you know, people are very excited about this. Things like the Mac framework in FreeBSD, which went into Mac OS X sandboxing stuff. SE Linux, of course, a very well-known mandatory access control scheme. And this is really about a system administrator specifying a policy along the lines of users who are cleared to secret shall not read documents that are labeled top secret. Things like that. Mandatory enforcement of system-wide policy by scattering a bunch of access control hooks in the kernel and then them calling out to a policy to say, is this okay? Is this okay? Is this okay? The problem with mandatory access control and why it's still not a great fit for the kinds of things that we want to do, well, first of all, Mac is really about the interests of the administrator. You want to express these systemic properties about well-defined policies such as a process that is running at a low integrity level shall not modify a file which is considered to have a high integrity level, things like that. But what we really want is something that will represent the interests of the user or the application writer, because the application structure, again, understands the kind of sandboxing that it's looking for. We would quite like it if, instead of having administrators modifying global policy, you know, you have to reconfigure a policy file and restart a daemon or whatever, we'd quite like it if an application, without privilege, can just say, conjure me a sandbox. I have a bit of code here. I would like it to run such that if it explodes, it can't kill the rest of me. I would quite like that. And we'd like that to happen without privilege. Finally, policy sources. So instead of having, lots of rules or 60,000 lines of rules in an SE Linux policy for Chromium, in a system config directory, we'd really like to extract some of this policy from the structure of the application and also from the UI. Because often you ask a user, which file would you like to open? And they tell you. And implicitly, they've already told you, I'm happy for this application to have access to that file. Well, that's a lot of useful information that we can use to get policy dynamically at runtime. And it would be quite nice if we could rely on that as opposed to saying, and then we have to modify the configuration in /etc/mytexteditor and say, it's now allowed to access this particular file. It would be really nice if we could just do that at runtime. And part of the reason why Mac is a poor model, so we said earlier that DAC is a poor model for sandboxing because if you can't express a policy as users, then it doesn't map very well. Part of the problem with Mac is that the system doesn't understand the security the security policy of an application in terms of things like you shouldn't have to teach the kernel or AppArmor or whatever what the same origin policy means. That's something that the web browser already understands. What we want to do is provide kernel primitives that the application can map its own security policy down into for enforcement, so you have robust enforcement, but without having to teach the whole system how to understand every possible security policy that every application might ever want to know about. And the other problem with Mac is that often you end up, because it's so very, very fine-grained, you often end up saying, well, in order to write a policy that'll just work, I better just write macros that confer huge swathes of rights to an application that, in fact, it doesn't actually need. But this dual coding problem of here's the code and it does one thing, and here's the policy that says what the code is allowed to do, you better make sure they're in sync. What typically happens is that people just write a policy that's way too loose, because users complain when the application doesn't work, and they don't complain so much if transparently you're assigning too much privilege. So that was DAC, that was MAC. The third model of access control is capabilities. So a capability is just any kind of unforgeable token of authority. Something like you say, I've forgotten my password, and you get emailed a big blob of crypto stuff. Well, that crypto stuff is a token that says, you know, I have been able to check this email account, and therefore that says something about my authority to, you know, reset the password, for instance. And capabilities are very delegation-centric. It's all about saying, I have a set of authorities, and I'm going to take a subset of that and hand it off to somebody else, and that somebody else can do stuff on my behalf. And then if they want, they can take a further subset and hand that off to somebody else. So all this comes out of research from, you know, like the 70s. This is the CAP computer that was built in the 70s at the University of Cambridge, and this sits out in our front hall and doesn't really do anything anymore. But this was all about exploring hardware capabilities and what you can do with a capability model. The problem is there hasn't been a whole lot of tech transfer. So many of the ideas from capability systems have inspired some things that happen today in language design, for instance. You know, you look at something like the Java virtual machine, a reference is quite a lot like a capability. It's not a pointer. You can't just make it up. Somebody has to pass it to you and delegate it to you. So that's sort of inspired by it, but we don't have a whole lot of capability systems running around today. So when we say we want to do some kind of capability-oriented research, we have a choice of where do we want to start. Do we want to start on the right-hand side, where we say there are research capability systems on the go today, Eros and Coyote OS and stuff. And these really have been designed for least privilege of every little bit of the operating system. And if you do something malicious in one bit, it really is going to be pretty confined. The problem is they don't really have any applications. Nobody's using them to do interesting things. On the other side, we have, you know, the monolithic kernel structures that we, you know, we all know and love, where people are, you know, there are a lot of security problems over here, but people are using them with real applications to do real stuff. So we kind of take a hybrid approach where we say we are going to bring some of the ideas from capability systems into FreeBSD, and we're going to allow you to immediately do useful things, get some immediate security benefits with small changes, and also provide a way to kind of incrementally move yourself gradually along this spectrum till you get more towards a proper least privileged design of the whole thing. So there's a long-term vision of the place you can go, but there's also some immediate benefit that you can get by doing small things right now. And this is kind of a pragmatic choice. There are some things about pure capability systems that we just can't do because we've said we're going to accept the fact that we're running on a Unix system. But we'll talk about those in a little bit. So CAPSCUM is this Unix capability hybrid, and the idea is to have, right now we can get some benefits, some very clear benefits, and we can also help you move in a direction that is the place you want to be in the future. And it really is mostly about capturing programmer intent. So there's code. The code says what it wants to do. And then we just provide the operating system foundations that just do the thing that the code expects. So CAPSCUM is, well, firstly, there's a system call API. And this is a portable thing. It composes with POSIX. And so it doesn't replace DAC and MAC, because those have their places, and they're useful for certain properties, but not for self-compartmentalization, not for sandboxing. So this is another API that you can use to do sandboxing stuff. We built a research prototype. It was based on FreeBSD 8, and we are merging bits of it into FreeBSD 9, and some of that merge has been done, and some of it will be done before FreeBSD 9. We hope to have all the kernel bits in. And then there's, so all the, you kind of get the security properties from the system call API, but then there's also a user space library whose API is a little bit more fluid at the moment that will help you kind of use this effectively by wrapping up some things and doing some things a little bit more easily for you. And so we built this in FreeBSD 9, but there's a Linux port underway at Google. And part of the goal of this talk is that people from other BSDs will look at it and say, actually, we think this is a reasonable API. Let's talk about, you know, whether we like all the details, and maybe we can, you know, we can do something together here, and we can improve the security of a lot of applications on a lot of BSDs. So the kernel primitives, there are three primitives. We have capability mode, which says a whole bunch of stuff that you're not allowed to do. We have capabilities, which is all about delegating access to things. And finally, we have process descriptors, which, depending on the time, we may or may not talk much about. So capability mode, this is something that a process calls cap enter, and we set a flag on the process credential. And from that point on, you no longer have access to any global namespaces. Once you enter capability mode, you can check in, but you can never check out. Any child processes that you fork, they will also be in capability mode. So there's no getting out of capability mode. It's a one-way thing. It's the Hotel California. And the idea is to cut off access to global namespaces. And these are not just the file system, but these are things like the syscontrol nibs and protocol things, NFS handles, what else? You know, CPU sets, POSIX IPC, System 5 IPC. There are lots of global namespaces that we've gone through and we've said, all right, you're no longer allowed to touch that because that is a name of a thing in the system that is not with respect to some subset of domain. And we cut these things off in two ways. One, there's sort of a very shallow syntactic interface thinning where we just say certain things like the open system call are just never allowed because there's no way to use that in a capability-friendly way. But some things we have deeper kind of semantic constraints that we've imposed. So it looks a bit like this, where over here we have a normal process running with ambient authority and it does a bunch of system calls and everything's fine. Once you've entered capability mode, some things change, some things don't. You know, system calls like read and write, where you're just operating on an object that you already have open. You already have a file descriptor. That means that somebody has already said it's okay for you to have this. Those system calls don't change at all. There are some system calls like open that are just not allowed because there is no way, there's no sensible way to use the open system call within a sandbox. If you want to do open things, well, maybe you can ask somebody to delegate you rights instead. But there are other things like open at, which are kind of interesting, where in order to, so open at says, I have a file descriptor for a directory. I would like to open something relative to that directory, you know, underneath it in the subtree. And that's kind of useful. But we want to make sure that you can't use that to, you know, look up relative to this directory, ... /etc/something. So we have to kind of do these deeper checks in lookup. And this comes into play when we do things like fexecve. So fexecve, you have a file descriptor, you say, execute this this binary for me, please. And you think, okay, that's all very, you know, file descriptor centric, and so you're not using any global names. But of course, within the binary, there is a hard-coded path to a runtime linker. And that's the sort of thing that, boy, you want to think really carefully about. Or if you have these kind of deep checks that we say, at the point where you turn names into something that means something in the system, that's the point where we can say, oh, you're addressing an absolute name, a global name. That's not allowed. And so we can stop you there. And so that is kind of useful. So what you can do is take applications like this, and you can decompose them into a logical application where you have a bit that runs with ambient authority, and then a bunch of other bits that run in capability mode. And this fits, for instance, the Chromium the Chromium sandboxing model, where you have the part that, you know, draws the window where you're typing in what URL you want to go to, etc. And then there's the bit that's dealing with JavaScript and, you know, interpreting images and, you know, codecs and stuff like that, where dangerous bad things might happen. And you would quite like to know that if this bit is compromised, that it can't, you know, read your private SSH keys. And so this is the kind of thing that we can do. So a lot of software can be categorized in this way. You can look at, you know, you have a model of you are preparing to do stuff and you are doing stuff. And what capability mode lets you do is to, when you call cap enter, go from here where you've set up, you've opened some files that you want to read, write, whatever. You call cap enter and you say, now I'm going to do the dangerous stuff, where this is the bit where I'm taking risks and I'm processing code that I got from who knows where. I'm processing, you know, network packets and stuff. So if that explodes, I'm no longer able to do all of the harm that could have been done. And so we'll see in some examples in a little bit of things like TCP dump, where instead of getting root privilege by compromising TCP dump, you get to mess up the TCP dump output file, and that's it. And that's a much better world to be in. But here's a question. So we showed you capability mode, and that lets you do some interesting things. But suppose you're doing this. So you have a program, you want to open some stuff. So you're opening a file, okay? You open it read-only. Then you say, all right, now let me make sure that I'm going to enter capability mode and not be able to do anything dangerous anymore. Okay, good. I'm in CapEnter. I'm no longer allowed to open files. You know, I can't use ambient authority. That's great. Ah, but wait a minute. Even though you've opened this file read-only, you can still fchmod it. And that just seems kind of wrong. So you can change a file that you thought was open read-only. And so this is where capabilities come in. So capability mode is about cutting off global namespaces, but capabilities are about refining the rights that you have on open file descriptors. So we restrict access to things. When you can say, here's a mask of the things that you're allowed to do, and you can take a subset of rights on a file descriptor. We always narrow interfaces. We never widen them. You can never get additional stuff. But cap new, you just pass it a file descriptor, and you say what mask of rights this thing should have. And then, OK, you've got a capability. And that you can pass that thing around. And a capability is itself a file descriptor. So it can be inherited by child processes. It can be passed around with Unix domain sockets in the way that we already know. So here's a picture. So if you have a bunch of file descriptors, then here's a file that's been opened in whatever mode. You can create a capability, which is a special kind of file descriptor that just wraps another file descriptor. And here we have a read-only version. Here's a read-write version. But these are capabilities that you wouldn't be able to use for fchmod or ioctl or, if you don't explicitly grant it, even seek, which makes it very safe to hand around things and not have to dupe file descriptors, because you can have the same underlying file, but if it can't seek, then it can't change where you're looking when you've delegated some other access. So this is a very kind of pragmatic approach to capabilities. We will say it's not a pure object capability system. You can't have arbitrary interposition, and not everything in the world is message passing in this system. But we think that's useful, because you can do native Unix-y things with native Unix-y speed for a lot of fast path operations. And you can do one of the interesting things that we do is directory capabilities, where you can open a directory, create a capability to that directory, and you can pass that thing around. And then you can say that processes in capability mode can then do lookups underneath that directory, but not above it. And so if you're Apache, you can say, OK, Apache worker number one, I will give you this directory capability to var www site 1, but not var www site 2. And then you can do whatever you want underneath that. And you can use the open at system calls, and the performance is just the same as if you weren't running in a sandbox. But you have been effectively constrained. So that is what happens with capabilities. So you have something similar to before, except this time, instead of keeping the file descriptor around, you create a capability to it, you close the old file descriptor, and now you get down here and you can no longer do fchmod, because you have cap read, you have cap seek, you don't have cap fchmod. So process descriptors are something else that we had to introduce. And this came out of the goal to have library self-compartmentalization. We would quite like for you to be able to write a library that is a codec library or something, and says, I understand internally which bits of me are risky and which bits are not. So I will create a new child process to do those and put it in sandbox capability mode in order to do that risky stuff. The trouble is that if you don't think you have any children, and you call into a library that's creating children, then what you don't want is to start getting signals about children that you didn't think you had. You can really confuse a process that way. So this is where process descriptors came from. Instead of fork, you use pdfork. And instead of getting back a PID, which refers to a global namespace, you get a file descriptor, which is known as a process descriptor. And you can poll it to get the status of your process and stuff. And when you close it to a first approximation, if you like, somebody can ask me later why it's just a first approximation. To a first approximation, when you close a process descriptor, that process goes away. So instead of having to send kill to something with respect to a global namespace, you just close the process descriptor. So the performance is very important. Now, for the science-y people among us, we didn't leave the error bars out. They're just too small to see, in fact, which is kind of a neat result. But you can see that, for instance, what are the things I particularly want to mention here? CapNew is a bit more expensive than dupe, for instance, and there is a cost associated with creating new capabilities. But performing operations on capabilities, so this is doing fstat on a shared memory segment, and this is fstat on a shared memory segment that's wrapped by a capability. And there is an additional pointer indirection in the kernel. So you have to say, I'm a capability. Well, what's the actual object I'm trying to perform the operation on? But that's it. And so you can see that the difference here is it's pretty small. Operations like reading 10,000 times with a regular file descriptor or with a capability wrapped file, it's about the same. And when you're entering sandboxes, this is the interesting thing. CapEnter is about the same cost as chroot, maybe slightly more, but it's cheaper than setuid. So it's a lot cheaper than chroot plus setuid. So entering this kind of sandbox, which provides much stronger isolation, could actually be faster than the porous DAC-based mechanism that has to do a bunch of additional bookkeeping. Because all we do here is enter the kernel, look up a credential, set a flag, and then we're done. And you're in capability mode. So that is kind of neat. Now, you remember we saw a picture like this earlier. So you have capability mode, and this kernel API lets you say CapEnter, boom. You're in this mode, you can never get out of it. But the picture that I showed before that one was this picture. Now, how do we do that? Because you enter capability mode, you're not allowed to leave capability mode, and often you want to, say, edit more than one file. And so, in a simple text editor that we made to demonstrate how stuff works, you edit a file, and then you say, okay, I'm done with that file, I want to save it. Now I want to open another file, I want to edit that. And so you keep going back and forth. And so this is why we have libcapsicum as well. So libcapsicum is a user space library that lets you use these kernel primitives in a way to do kind of higher level functions like create me a sandbox over there. And when you create it, please make sure that it has no file descriptors except the ones that I've explicitly said, pass these ones into the sandbox when it's created. And also things like, make sure I haven't accidentally forgotten about some memory mappings that happened previously. Make me a fresh, clean, new sandbox with only those authorities that I've explicitly passed in. And so libcapsicum lets you do things like this. You call lcstart, and then you have the process from up here. You can open files, and you can do stuff, and you can communicate with the user. And there's also a sandbox process and a socket pair, so they can talk back and forth. And across this socket pair, you can pass things like, say, the user has requested you do something to this other file. Here's a file descriptor, and pass it along. Looking at the time, I'm definitely not going to explain this in any detail. But if somebody's looking for a question to ask later and you haven't thought of anything else, ask about the runtime linker, because that's an interesting story. So we've looked at the system call API, the kernel primitives, and the user space library that helps you wrap up things and flush address spaces and make sure that you have a sandbox started in a pristine state. But the question that you might be asking is, does it work? So you've created this nice research prototype, but can you do anything useful with it? And we think the answer is yes. So we've adapted four applications here to use Capsicum, and they're different kinds of applications, and we've used different approaches to them. In some cases, the system call API, in some cases, using libcapsicum. In some cases, we've used this to reinforce some existing separation. So DH client already has the idea of separation. Chromium already has the idea of separation, and it understands that it's in multiple bits. We reinforce that. In other cases, like TCP dump, and in gzip, we've created new separation that wasn't there before and showed that it works. So the TCP dump case. TCP dump is an excellent candidate for this sort of work because it has full system privilege because you have to be able to do arbitrary things with sockets and listen to stuff. and it also processes arbitrary network code, or arbitrary packets using network code that, you know, who knows who wrote all of the things that say, oh, I understand this format, I'm going to turn it into something I can print out. And so there have been historic vulnerabilities in this, and you know, whenever you find a TCP dump vulnerability, you get root privilege usually. And so this is a bit of a problem. And it also fits this model very well, where initially, you know, you open a packet filter, and then when you're done that, you say, okay, now I'm going to start doing a bunch of dangerous stuff, which is accepting, looking at packets and saying, okay, I can decode this. So here's the change. Here's what we had to do to introduce sandboxing, compartmentalization, in TCP dump. And you can see it's a two-line change. But if you look carefully, you might notice that I'm eliding over a detail, which is this, the fact that it was, in fact, an eight-line change. Because before we entered the sandbox, we said, well, you know, you still have just file descriptors for standard in and standard out. And if you can do arbitrary things on standard in and standard out, you can take over the user's console, then you can do all kinds of interesting things, can't you? So first we limit those things to, you know, you can fstat, you can seek, you can write to standard out, etc. And then we enter capability mode, and then really all you can do, if you compromise somebody's TCP dump that's running by sending a bad packet out over the network and having them read it, all you can do is mess up the dump file, and that's it. Or print output that is incorrect. But you can't do arbitrary things to their console anymore. So instead of root privilege that lets you completely compromise the system by sending one bad packet over the network, now you've just messed up their network monitoring a little bit, but you are not root on their box. So we think this is pretty useful, and the fact that it's an eight-line diff is also pretty cool. DH client has a very similar kind of patch. In this case, there's an existing idea of separation doing the chroot set UID thing, but it's, again, kind of porous because it cuts off access to some things and it isolates you a bit, but there are some things that it doesn't isolate you from. And boy, wouldn't it be a shame if you could still do arbitrary things to, you know, the X11 server. So we reinforce this separation by saying, okay, when you do the chroot set UID thing, also call cap enter. And now we cut off access to all global namespaces, and we reduce some of the excessive privilege that you had on the socket to do weird ioctly things. Gzip. Gzip has also historically had vulnerabilities. And Gzip's interesting because it's not always run as root. You know, very often, you're running it as a user. And what you really don't want to do is say, in order to have compartmentalization within Gzip, you have to have a set UID root Gzip. That would be really unfortunate if it required privilege. So we've introduced compartmentalization to Gzip where it wasn't there before without requiring any privilege whatsoever. And that's using the libcapsicum model where you say there's going to be this bit of the process or this bit of the application, which is the bit that says I'm opening this input file, I'm opening this output file. And then there's this bit that says, ah, thank you for those file descriptors. I will read from one, compress or decompress or whatever, and I will write to the other one. So we proxied three functions, compress, uncompress, and unbzip2. And in doing this proxying and adding RPCs, this was a bigger change. This is, you know, 409 lines because Gzip wasn't structured for proxying of these functions. And most of this code is just marshalling and unmarshalling RPCs. And the performance that we got out of Gzip is quite interesting. So you can see that, yes, there's definitely a cost to entering the sandbox, because you're saying, you know, you're going to spawn a new process, and once you get inside of it, you're going to flush its address space, you're going to make sure that it doesn't have any file descriptors that you didn't intend for it to have, there's a socket pair gets set up, and you talk to each other, etc. There is definitely a cost, but it's a fixed overhead, and there's no per byte overhead. And when you get up to larger and larger file sizes that you're compressing, of course, you don't really notice the difference at all. So that's an important property, that because we have this hybrid approach where you can still do, you know, read, write, etc., within a sandbox with normal Unix speed, Gzip still runs quickly. Finally, Chromium. Chromium is obviously a large and complicated application, and it already understands, and you know, I think I said before, that Chromium has more lines of code than the FreeBSD kernel. And Chromium already has an idea of compartmentalization. And in fact, when we count capsicum, Chromium has six different ways of doing compartmentalization on different platforms. So it's a really great opportunity to compare approaches to sandboxing. So here are the different ways that Chromium does sandboxing currently. If we just look at very generally before we dig into any details, you'll see the DAC methods have a lot of red X's. They tend to be very porous and not actually isolate you as much as you'd like. Some of the Mac stuff is functional, but because of, in some cases, the privilege requirement, or because of the dual coding problem, it's still not a great fit because you end up having to do a lot more stuff than you would like in order to get the sandboxing, which works better than DAC, but still not great. And with capabilities, well, obviously at the bottom, we think that Capsicum is pretty great. So we'll start by noticing here, there are a couple of systems that require a lot of lines of code in order to do the sandboxing. And this is because, so in DAC, this Windows thing where you say, I'll give you a null security identifier and you can't touch anything with an ACL. And then in Linux, seccomp, which is something where it almost looks a bit like capenter, except when you enter a seccomp sandbox, you're allowed to read, write, exit, and that's all. In both cases, in order to do all the stuff that you legitimately, reasonably need to do, you end up proxying a whole bunch of functionality between the bit that has privilege and the bit that doesn't, such that, you know, here you've got something like 2,000 lines of handcrafted assembly, all of which is absolutely security critical. You can't get one line of that wrong in order to proxy stuff back and forth. And furthermore, because that sort of thing is really hard to get right, you end up, you know, in the seccomp version here, I think you end up proxying, just you say, okay, fine, you can read anything on the file system, because doing more intricate checks in a way that performs well is just so hard to get right. The Windows DAC is really, really very porous because it turns out there are lots of things that don't have ACLs, like USB thumb drives. So if you're running Chromium in a sandbox on Windows, then sure, you can't access anything that's NTFS, but anything that's FAT32, sure, yeah, thumb drive, you can read that, why not? And also you look at, you know, you don't get the network protection and IPC and things. And this S not equal to S prime thing, this is whether or not the different sandboxes are kept isolated. So if there is there an understanding of this sandbox for this web page is not the same thing as this sandbox for this web page. SE Linux has that problem, you know, you have Chrome Sandbox T or something like that is the SE Linux label that's associated with a sandbox, but it could be run by any user, etc. And certainly all the sandboxes run by Chromium have the same label, at least they used to when we made this table. I'm not sure if that's still true. but it's really hard to dynamically reconfigure that at runtime. You could have Chrome Sandbox 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, T, etc. I mean, but how many of these things should you make? And you know, having to reconfigure all of this with system privilege is quite unfortunate. And that's really because, you know, mandatory access control is about protecting the system from users. It's not about protecting bits of application from themselves or from each other. And as you can see, you have to have privilege in a lot of cases in order to create a sandbox. So to have less privilege, you must first acquire more privilege. And two out of the three versions of the Linux sandbox, this is the case. Finally, we have Capsicum, which you see has a lot of check marks because we think it's really great. I mean, obviously, we think it's all right. And furthermore, you'll notice that the change is very small. You know, you have 100 lines of code to say, I see you need all these file descriptors for fonts and, you know, whatever else. Let me limit those so that you can read fonts, but you can't do weird fchmod things and stuff like that. And then we'll enter capability mode, and then you can't access, you know, networks and bits of shared memory for IPC and things like that. So Capsicum, there's a system call API, which has capability mode, capabilities, and process descriptors. We have a user space library that helps you start sandboxes in a clean, known configuration. And we've modified some applications to show and convince ourselves, and I hope convince you, that it does, in fact, actually work. But there are still questions to be answered. So we've created a mechanism. Now the question is, where does policy come from? Well, obviously, some of it comes from application structure, because the application knows this is the bit of me that I want to be separate, so I can, you know, call capenter, etc. But if an application doesn't have separation already, then it's kind of weird to put it in. It can be a difficult thing to know where the line should be drawn. So for things like SSHD, you know, it's pretty clear that you want keys in one thing and dangerous stuff in another thing. But an application that can be decomposed into a whole bunch of components, where is the right place to draw those lines? The GZIP case was interesting because when we introduced sandboxing and compartmentalization, the performance went up. It got much faster. We said, that can't possibly be right. And as it turns out, it's because there's a global variable defined in GZIP that says, how hard do I want to try to do this compression? And that variable, you know, it existed in both processes, but it was only assigned to in the master process after we had already split off the sandbox process. And on the first blush, we just didn't see that that was, a global variable that we needed to deal with. And so it just didn't, you know, it always tried to compress with the easiest compression, so it got a lot faster. And we said, that's not right. And then we saw, oh, this is what's going on. Well, we better proxy that too. But that's the sort of thing where you don't want to have that kind of faulting in process with more sophisticated and complex applications. That would be really, really unfortunate. So we still need some analysis of program structure, and there's more research going on, again, sponsored by Google, to try and make tools with the help of compilers and things that will let you figure out where it is that you want that separation to go. And also users, this GBAC we're calling gesture-based access control, and so that's stuff where the user has done something, they've dragged a file into a window. Clearly, that means that unless they did it by accident, because somebody told them to do it, that has implications, and that says the user probably wants that application to be able to access that file. And so if we could do a lot of delegation-centric access control that way, that'd be great. Capabilities are a great fit for that. So that's, where are we getting policy from? The other thing is, where are we going to put compartmentalization? So how are we going to compartmentalize libraries? Lots of libraries don't care about files. They care about buffers of memory. And so that's a difficult thing to wrap. So we didn't wrap libz with Capsicum. We wrapped gzip, because gzip cares about file descriptors, which are things that mean we can have great performance. But how should we do libraries in a sophisticated way? That's an open question. What services should we provide? There are things like TCP dump can do all of its stuff, but sometimes it has an IP address, and we would like to turn that into a name that it can print out on the screen. And all of a sudden, it tries to go off and read resolve.conf. And we say, no, you're not allowed to read resolve.conf. What are you talking about? And so that's an example of the kind of higher-level services that we need to provide to sandboxes, and the question is still, which services should we be providing? And desktop environments, we think, are an excellent place to put compartmentalization. In KDE, KDE already understands the idea that a KDE application should never talk to a web server itself. It should start a KIO slave, which already understands how to talk HTTP, etc., and it's in another process, and it's going to go off and talk to the web server for you and say, ding, I'm done. And that's an excellent candidate for a sandbox to be able to talk to a thing that's in a sandbox to be able to talk to a web server. That's the kind of thing that, boy, wouldn't it be cool if we could have a capsicumized version of KDE. So the next steps for you, we hope that you will look at our API. We hope that if you write applications, like Pavel and other people, that you'll actually use the API and say, is this a good fit for the kind of thing that I want to do? And we are really hoping that other people will pick up this API and implement it. It's all BSD licensed, obviously, so you can take the implementation too. But we really do think that this is an API that could make the world a slightly better place by making it easier for applications to compartmentalize themselves. And so that when they say, I would like to have a bit more security, that the operating system just makes it easy. And we think if we could see this there's a Linux port underway, but who knows what the politics of getting that back into upstream Linux will be. But if we could say, all the BSDs are using it, and maybe Apple would pick it up in Mac OS X or something after we get it in FreeBSD, then that would be a much more compelling argument. So, Capsicum, we think it's a pragmatic approach. It's a hybrid approach to bringing capabilities into Unix. It supplements DAC and Mac rather than replacing it, because those are still fine for what they're good at, but we think that they're really not a great fit for sandboxing. We need something else. We need something that looks a bit like Capsicum, and that where you're creating sandboxes with Capsicum, it's faster than some of the existing things. It certainly provides much cleaner abstractions for programmers. You don't have to understand setuid root binaries and cheroots and blah, blah, blah. You just say, I want to be in a sandbox now, please. And it's also more secure, because it really does isolate. There are places where applications think they have compartmentalization, but now they can actually have it. We are merging this into FreeBSD 9, and we hope that you will come and join us. So are there any questions? So it is entirely about processes, just because if the Unix process model address space separation and stuff, doing separation within the process would be problematic because threads can all write on each other's memory and stuff, and there's no actual separation there. So we say that the unit of separation in Unix is a process, and so we say, why don't you stick that process into a sandbox? There is other research that we're doing, which is kind of followed on from this, that said, well, what if we could redesign the hardware so we didn't have to make that assumption anymore? What if we could have separation within an address space? And that stuff that we're doing with DARPA and other people. But, on current hardware and the current Unix process model. Mm-hmm. So the current stuff that we're doing wouldn't be at all a good fit for that, just because you can always, things that are within the same address space can always stomp on each other's memory and trick each other into writing things that they didn't mean to write, etc. So there isn't really any separation available within an address space. So we're just going to take that as the foundation. Right, so this is the runtime linker question. So what we have to do is we directly execute a runtime linker, which has been taught to understand capability mode. The normal runtime linker doesn't behave very well in capability mode, but we have a runtime linker that does, and it's a slightly patched version. And what it does is it, we exec that runtime linker, so we've cleaned up all the memory mappings and stuff, so we start with a fresh address space. And then when it executes, it understands that at file descriptor 3, I think, there's going to be a bit of shared memory that describes the file descriptors you're supposed to keep around, kind of thing. And those file descriptors you will keep open, and all the other ones you're going to close. And then you're going to take those ones that you should keep and move them down to 4, 5, 6, etc. And so you have to explicitly say, here's the set of file descriptors that I would like to have available in the sandbox. And you have to have, so you can call LC start from within another sandbox, but you already have to have a file descriptor for the capability aware runtime linker and the binary that you want to execute. So the role-based access control thing really is this discretionary access control model. Pardon? Right. Well, would you like to talk about Plash? And we did things like with that simple Qt text editor that I showed you, we changed the Qt libraries so that when you say show a file picker dialog and then open whatever file was picked, in fact what you have is a proxy call to something outside the sandbox that is allowed to open dialogs, and then it opens the file for you and hands it back, kind of thing. And in that particular case, because applications really usually care about paths as opposed to file descriptors, we had to do stuff where you turn a file name into a crypto token and pass that around. But yeah, so role-based access control really is about expressing things in terms of users, and anything that's sudo-y, well, I mean, that again requires privilege escalation in order to lose privilege, which what we'd really like to be able to say is just create me an anonymous thing which is confined and stick some code in it. And out of that you can build really interesting things. Right, so the kinds of things that well, of course, everything is a file. So, you know, the sorts of things that we do sometimes are pass around descriptors for anonymous shared memory segments, for instance. So you say, I would like a bunch of memory, and it doesn't have any name in a global namespace, but it does have a file descriptor associated with it, and I can hand that around. And then, so, you know, applications can share memory in that way and write stuff in and read stuff out. And that is, we use that in libcapsicum to set up some of the initialization stuff. When you say, here's the list of file descriptors that ought to be open, and you know the name that you can pretend they have, all of that goes into an anonymous shared memory segment, which gets passed around. So debugging is really hard because we've turned a local programming thing into a distributed system, and distributed systems are kind of notoriously difficult to debug. So the experience so far has been that we've done things with applications that haven't required a whole lot of attaching GDB, etc. Certainly, so the Chromium story is they, you know, when they want to debug, the first thing they do is throw in the single process or, you know, don't sandbox flag or whatever, and everything runs in one address space, and then you can actually look at a stack of function calls and stuff. And distributed debugging would require something that says, I see that you've called an RPC, and in this other process, it's servicing an RPC, so why don't I glue those together into a logical stack for you, that sort of thing. But we haven't really done any work on that. And certainly some of the research that we're doing where we say, what if you could change the hardware? Some of that is premised on the idea of separation within an address space, so traditional debuggers are easier to use. But for this, definitely, more tools are required. No. You can do all the usual stuff, but the problem is if your one application has become eight processes, then you need to attach to all of them and say, okay, which one is in the middle of an RPC send and which one's in the middle of processing, and, oh, that turned into another RPC, so I better go off and inspect that process. And, you know, it becomes much more, you can't just say, break when you get here and show me the call stack. It becomes a very much more difficult problem. And I think there are commercial tools that try to address some of these things, but it'd be really nice if we had a DGDB or something which understands RPCs and can put together a logical call stack. Yeah. Right. So certainly we're not saying please give us a firm commitment right now that says OpenBSD is definitely going to use it, but we do think that, you know, anybody who cares about privilege separation, anybody who cares about least privilege should be interested in these kinds of ideas, And we think that we have a reasonable API, but we're certainly open to talking about that with other people, and people say, no, you need to modify this API. Well, okay, great. It would be really nice if we could have kind of a unified BSD story about application sandboxing that is better than on lots of other OSs. Not really. I mean, well, we've tried to do a bunch of things. Most of them were kind of small demonstration things, and they all, you know, worked. Along the way, we discovered things like, look at this. The Qt application has a different model for understanding what it means to open a file than the operating system has. Isn't that interesting? We're going to now have to, you know, write some more code. That means we can provide a service that Qt understands, because it says open a file, picker dialog, and return a path. And it says, I'm going to open that file, I'm going to read some stuff, close it. And then later when I save it, I'm going to open a writable descriptor, write stuff out, and close it. And that's a different model. So we had to write some code which could deal with the fact that there is a different model and kind of, you know, supply the API that it expects to have. And we expect there are going to be a bunch more things like that, where we say we really do need services that, you know, can do resolving of stuff, or saying, give me a font directory, please, or, you know, give me some configuration stuff. And those are things that we expect we can fault in. They just need to be faulted in. There are some things where traditional OCAP systems, pure capability systems, just do everything with message passing. But you have to have very, very fast message passing primitives for that to work. Capsicum logical application is several processes. And so this is the same model that you have in something like Chrome, where the UI is obviously drawn by one process, but underneath the hood, it's actually talking to a bunch of different things. Yeah, so we haven't modified any kernel primitives around process management. And that's actually something that would be really interesting to do, is to have an explicit abstraction for a set of things that cooperatively and logically are one thing, because that would make it much easier to say, close this logical group of stuff and just kill them all. Because one of the problems with process descriptors is, it's a file descriptor, and it's when the last one closes, the process goes away, and you can have a cycle of them. And everybody can be holding each other's process descriptors and make it, kind of annoying to shut your application down sometimes. Right, and is that time then? John walked into the room. Okay. Hey.
Thanks for your talk. It's very good.
Thanks.
My name's Cliff Green.
Okay.
I'm from a local company. Your demo, actually.
Let me just turn my microphone.